Hey, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is International Union versus Labor Board. Mr. Clavin.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Brian Lavin. I'm the attorney for the International Union of Engineers, Local 150, AFL-CIO. Your Honor, Local 150 filed a petition for review of a decision of the National Labor Relations Board in which the board found certain violations of Section 8A1 of the National Labor Relations Act, but did not find violations of Section 8A3 of the Act with respect to the employer's refusal to hire or consider for hire certain union-affiliated applicants. It is that portion of the board's award that is before you today. No appeal was taken with respect to the 8A1 findings by either the board or the employer. Essentially, the case before you, Your Honor, is the Salting case. Salting, as this court has stated and recognized, and the board has recognized, the practice used by unions in which they have members or union organizers seek to obtain employment at non-union companies for the purpose of organizing.
Well, no, the purpose is to precipitate unfair labor practices by the employer.
Your Honor,
if they were seriously interested in organizing, they wouldn't identify themselves as union members when they apply for employment.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that point.
What's the purpose of identifying themselves as union people when
they
apply for employment?
They have every right to identify themselves.
Excuse me? What is the purpose, I said?
The purpose is to advise the employer that they are pro-union employees.
And why would you want to advise an employer of that if you're trying to organize workers?
To let them, they have a right to apply for a job.
You're not answering my question. What is the purpose? If the genuine purpose of these Salters is to organize the labor force,
correct,
why do they advise the employer that they're union organizers?
They advise the employers that they're union organizers is so the employer cannot later dispute knowledge that they are pro-union employees and they're pro-union applicants and seeking employment with their company. For example, in a gender discrimination case, you don't request females to dress up like males to obtain jobs with employers. These individuals are pro-union applicants. They have a right to walk into an employer's office and be proud of their union affiliation and still obtain the same consideration for hire and same consideration for employment as somebody who chooses not to disclose whether they are for a union or against a union.
Well, the point is, though, you disclose that at the outset as opposed to someone coming in sort of under the radar and then trying to organize that.
I understand that, Your Honor, but they have a right,
they have the
ability to do that. There's nothing that requires somebody to hide or be embarrassed of their union affiliation just to obtain a job. In fact, the Act protects them in their search for employment and to be proud of their union affiliation and to advise and say, I'm going to engage in protected activity when I work for you.
But do these guys really want a job?
These people testify that they want a job. These individuals that sought employment in 97 and 98.
Do they receive union salaries as well?
Some of them were union business agents. Some of them were rank and file members in the 1997 and 1998 campaign. So some received a salary, some did not. They were all instructed prior to going to obtain employment at Brandt that you are going there. If Brandt hires you, you are to take the job. If you are not interested in taking the job, don't go down to Brandt and apply. We're not interested in you. We want someone who's going to go there and get hired, and once hired, persuade the other employees about the benefits of being union.
And then quit.
That's
and then
not
move that on to the next firm.
That is not necessarily the case,
that's
Your Honor.
What they do, though.
No, it's not, Your Honor. Your Honor, we have union members that have been employed right now. It's not in the record of this case, but I will give you an example. At a steel mill in Iowa, an individual was employed there for over 2 years as a union organizer, and now they have a union contract, and he's still working there. And every day he showed up, punched his time clock, and went out and operated equipment, and that's what he did. So they are not there just simply to quit and move on to the next one. Some, I will not say that some don't, but some stay there and work side by side and continue to work there.
Okay, well, thanks for the clarification.
You're welcome, Your Honor. This case here, Your Honor, the board adopted the ALJ's findings that the general counsel proved a prima facie case of refusal to hire and refusal to consider for hire. The board, even applying the new FES standard, said that the judge's decision was consistent with that standard, and the general counsel proved that the employer at the time of the 1997 and 1998 campaigns was hiring or had concrete plans to hire, the applicants were qualified for employment, and anti-union animus contributed to the decision of the employer not to hire. So a prima facie case was found by the ALJ and affirmed by the board. And again, there's no appeal taken on that finding. What this comes down to, essentially, is then the burden shifting under the right line case, where once a prima facie case has been established, under the right line decision, the burden then shifts to the employer to prove that they had a legitimate business justification for their refusal to hire the union-affiliated applicants or refusal to consider the applicants. And they would have taken that same action against those applicants regardless of their union status. Further, the employer has to show by a preponderance of the evidence that it's not just a good reason they came up with, or particularly an after-the-fact reason that they came up with, but it was the true reason, it was the real reason for why they took the action they did. Here, what the board looked at was a hiring policy that this employer put into evidence as the basis for saying the employer utilized or met its right-line burden. Local 150 submits on this appeal that the board erred in several respects in accepting that right-line defense. First, it's significant to this appeal in this case that the 8A1 findings of animus that the board found relate directly to the hiring and the practices and procedures that this employer engaged in 97 and 98.
Well, wasn't the distinction, though, the whatever the violation was, adding more, like the ID card and what was the other one?
It was more than just the ID card, Your Honor. You're correct.
There were two things.
It was posting
a
sign. Right. It was treating individuals differently with respect to the signs that were posted.
But what about the long-term policy of referrals and having a, I don't know what you would call it, but a pool of people who were referred applicants?
First off, the long-term nature of that portion of the policy was never established. They testified about the Monday rule. That is, they claimed they had a rule that in place that applications should only be, would only be accepted on Mondays. They claimed that has been around for a while. But this hiring preferences or hierarchy, the employer never said when exactly that came into being. Rather, they testified and admitted that it, the actual written memorialization of this policy didn't occur until right before the union applicants walked in the door. Convenient, we suggest, that they picked the day, you know, the month period beforehand, that they put this in writing. Further, Your Honor, I think it's significant that the record shows that the memorialization of this hiring policy was not done simply by the employer, but the record shows that they brought in a union buster, if you will, a consulting group called Cosmos Consulting Group, whose website, as the records show, goes under the designation unionknow.com, to come in and help them put together this hiring hierarchy and procedure. The memorialization, then, is timing-wise right in conjunction with when the union campaign, at least the consulting, started. Further, the records show organizing of this employer had been going on for a number of years, with the union trying different tactics and methods. So the union was certainly aware of the union's, or the employer was certainly aware of the union's desire to organize its workforce. It brings in a union buster to help formalize the policy, and now it's this policy that the board's relying on to say is a right-line defense.
Are you arguing that the board committed a legal error, or just that its decision isn't supported by substantial evidence?
Your Honor, we are arguing before you that the board committed a legal error by permitting this employer to utilize this policy and the record that was showing the establishment and the maintenance and use of the policy as a right-line defense. But we're also arguing then that even if the court finds that they could use such a policy, how it was used in this case does not, the board erred in permitting it to be right line, particularly when the board has allowed similar types of hiring rules in the past to be used as right line defenses. They require basically two things. It's been proven to be longstanding, and also that it's been applied in a non-discriminatory
fashion. I don't understand your first point. What do you mean by it's a legal error to allow such a policy ever to be a defense?
This policy, Your Honor.
This is the policy of just hiring from the referrals?
Correct.
Referred people.
This policy, Your Honor, effectively and directly prohibited the ability of pro-union applicants to obtain a job with the employer. They had five categories that they said. Current employees, and similarly that people that were on layoff, that would give a preference, top priority. Former employees with the employer with proven safety records would get next priority. And then it would be recommendations either by a supervisor or by a current employee. And last but not least, unknown applicants. Now, the first thing is, at the meeting in June, the vice president said, we're no longer accepting Category E. We put the sign on the door in response, in direct response to Local 150 salting applications, that we are no longer taking applications over the counter. That's an undisputed fact that was never appealed, and that was found by the board. And further, in 98, one of the foremen confirmed, we don't hire any more off the street.
This is a substantial evidence. I thought you were arguing that an otherwise reasonable practice that prevents salting is unlawful.
What I'm arguing, Your Honor, is now if you look at that policy and you eliminate Category E, then the only way a pro-union applicant can get hired at this company is if they were a current employee, a former employee, or recommended by a supervisor.
Okay, so the question is, suppose a company adopted, you know, these three rules that are confined its hiring to these three categories, and it did it not for anti-union reasons, it just did it because that was a sensible way of running its business, but the consequence was to prevent salting. Is your argument that that would be unlawful?
Our argument is if the policy on its face effectively precluded union applicants from having any meaningful opportunity from getting hired, it would be unlawful. For example, the board in a recent case called the Aztec decision found that...
I think that goes too far because there might be just a variety of reasonable employment rules that have the effect of preventing salting.
And, Your Honor, in this case, by limiting it just to those categories, I think it allow if the board erred in saying legally this.
But what if it were reasonable to do that? Quite apart from any labor policies, it's just the way everybody has always done things in a particular industry.
Your Honor, I think in the cases and the case we have here, with limiting to those four factors, I think the board and applying to even another industry, I think it would still be unlawful because individuals have a right to be considered for employment and to have some sort of ability to be hired for a job. And if you preclude for a class of people who are union affiliated from having that meaningful right, I think a violation of the Act still stands under the inherently destructive analysis shown in the Great Dane Trailer case.
Okay, so, you want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I just want to touch on one thing as well. In terms of applying this evenly, the record shows that they did not apply this in a non-discriminatory fashion, that they deviated from it by using referrals from, they accepted referrals from people that are not identified as current employees or current supervisors.
Those are the EEO referrals, weren't they? Or some
those were EEO referrals, but nothing in the policy said that EEO referrals should get priority, Your Honor.
I think they had to get it to get government contracts, which I admit
Your Honor, that it's simply a goal that you have to obtain. It's not a requirement. And we had minority and female applicants who were pro-union that they could have hired and still satisfy that. They applied, Your Honor. I'm down to 1 minute left, so I'll reserve that for
rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Glavin. Mr. Side, Steve, if you prefer.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Side for the Labor Board. 4 points that union counsel has raised that I'd like to address. First, the board very specifically found that this was a long-term policy. The credited testimony of company official Terry Brandt, who specifically credited that this went back to 1994, that there was a good business reason for developing and implementing the policy. Second, the posting of the policy, which took place in early 1997, prior to the union salting campaign, that was never alleged by the general counsel to be improper. Third, the union has never disputed that under the company's preferential hiring system, it received a sufficient number of referred applicants that it did not hire a single walk-in applicant, regardless of union affiliation, and there are actually dozens of referred applicants who were never hired. Fourth, the board has specifically found that preferential systems that are not implemented for discriminatory reasons, that those are okay, that those are acceptable, and those cases are cited in the board's brief, the Zurn Zepco case and the Custom Topsoil case. The union has never disputed the board's rationale in those cases. And finally, the reference to the Aztec case, which involved an inherently destructive situation where, regardless of motivation, the board found a hiring policy improper, that is not an issue in this case. There's never been an allegation that the company's system developed for non-discriminatory reasons is in and of itself inherently destructive. And unless this court has any additional questions, would simply ask that it enforce the board's order.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stein. Mr. Avakian, do you have something you'd like to add?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. Michael Avakian for Brandt Construction. The one point I think that needs to also be emphasized is that the employer's referral policy that it utilized did not prevent the labor union from referring people. And the record actually demonstrates that at least two people, for instance, Chuck Stevens is one, and Brian Strzok was the other person, who actually got referred, were members of the Local 150, maybe unknowing to Brandt or the Brandt employees, but got referred by Brandt employees to the employee of Brandt Construction. And secondly, during the period
Who did the referrals?
Mike Taylor referred Brian Strzok.
No, I meant the category of who did Brandt seek references from? A worker for them, they wouldn't be interested. So there must be some category of people who they.
The well, if since Brandt is in the excavation, concrete, road construction business, it was looking for people that would...
Other contractors, is that it?
Yeah.
So these two people you mentioned were union members. They were referred by a contractor?
No, they were referred by our actual employees.
Oh, by your employees?
By our own employees. So if the point is our referral policy somehow, because of its operation, excluded the opportunity of Local 150 members or to get into or be referred by its own employees, it's not in the record in this case. In fact, the record's elsewise. And the second point I was going to make was the fact that during the during this period of time, the union had Brandt employees on the payroll, had on their own payrolls in order to further their organizing interests, and those people maintained their employment without any problems and any other type of unfair labor practices. And if there are no other questions, I'll end mine.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Beckman. Mr. Lavin, 1 minute.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll be very brief. Just to address the last point made by the company, Brian Strzok, who they refer to, was not a member of Local 150, nor referred by Local 150 when he got hired. He was hired on his own. It was only after he was fired by Brandt that he came to the union and started talking to me. But in fact, he was never a member of the union, even at the trial. Chuck Stevens was a former employee of Brandt that did get hired through the supervisor's recommendation, but that was the case where the supervisor told him, because 150 is trying to organize us, and we'll have to get you into the back door. Finally, there were at least four other applicants in 1997 that were former employees of Brandt that did not get that preference that Mr. Bacon is talking about, the Category 2 preference on their list. They worked for Brandt in the past. They were never given that preference.
What's that mean?
Again, it showed the policy was not being applied in a non-discriminatory manner.
Well, I don't think there's any dispute that a lot of the people who were referred, et cetera, didn't get hired.
What it's showing, though, Your Honor, is that if they're saying that the longstanding policy is to give preferences in this order, we're showing that they deviated from that policy. But if you use it as a white line defense, they have to show they apply it in a non-discriminatory fashion.
And hired somebody else instead.
Correct. We had people that met Category 2, Your Honor, and yet they hired people referred from this outside source or wherever. And we had four people in Category 2 that didn't get hired either. We think that shows that what this was another extension of the board's clear findings that this employer intentionally manipulated and changed its hiring policies and practices in order to make it more onerous and to restrict the ability of pro-union applicants to apply for jobs and get hired for jobs with this employer. That finding carries over to this policy as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much to all counsel. Next case.